This is an interview with Pandara Lavanis, who was a secretary from January 1987 to August 1989 in the office of the Honourable Robert Hawke, Prime Minister of Australia. Pandara will be speaking with me, Joan Armitage, for the Oral History Program conducted by the Museum of Australian Democracy at Old Parliament House. Pandara, on behalf of the Director of the Museum, I'd like to thank you for agreeing to participate in this program. Do you understand that the Commonwealth owns copyright in the interview material, but disclosure will be subject to any disclosure restrictions you impose in completing the rights agreement?
I do.
Thank you. This being so, may we have your permission to make a transcript or a summary of this recording, should we decide to make one?
I provide my permission.
Thank you. This interview is taking place today on the 6th of June 2014 in the Museum of Australian Democracy at Old Parliament House. Pandara, tell me please, when and where were you born?
I was born on the 22nd of February 1968 in Griffith in New South Wales.
Okay. When did you come to Canberra?
My family moved to Canberra when I was about 10 in 1978. My father was a blue-collar worker, and my mother, he was a refrigeration mechanic. My mother was a stay-at-home mum, but also our family owned an ice manufacturing business. Okay. And we moved to Canberra for job opportunities for my brothers and sister. Mm-hmm. And also to be closer to medical attention for my sister, who was unwell at the time.
Okay. Were your parents Australian-born?
My father was Australian-born. My mother was born overseas in Greece in a small village called Vassilopoulo. Mm-hmm. His father was Greek, my grandfather, on my father's side, retired to Greece. My father travelled to Greece to spend some time with his father, and my father owned a number of properties where he grew olive trees. Mm. Olive trees. My father stayed with my grandfather, and my mother would pick olives on one of my grandfather's properties. Mm. My grandfather asked my mother if she would stay on to clean and cook while his son was visiting, and that's where my father met my mother, and they married. On the island of Ithaca, which is where my grandfather lived, and mm. that's where his properties were. And my parents married on the island of Ithaca.
So it was a true romance.
It was indeed.
So what level of formal education did you attain?
I completed Year 12 certificate at Stirling College here in the ACT. Mm. Different to the New South Wales system, Year 11 and 12 here is considered college. And I completed the ACT Year 12 certificate under that system.
What was your first job?
In college, the opportunities to study were... each student was able to enrol in whichever units they wanted to. And some of the units that were offered to me at the time were typing, shorthand and secretarial studies. I, having come from a blue-collar working type of family, I was encouraged to finish Year 12 and get out into the workforce and start earning some money and finding the best job I could. So to do that, knowing that I didn't have too many other skills or other vocational skills that I thought I'd do shorthand and typing and then secretarial studies. And at the end of the secretarial studies, I completed with shorthand of 100 words per minute, and our secretarial studies teacher gave us a list of departments in Canberra, government departments, and suggested that we write to four or five of them seeking jobs. Because shorthand at the time was highly sought after, each department that I wrote to offered me an interview, and I was successful in getting a job with the first two departments that I was interviewed by. At that time, stenographers were very highly sought after, so if you had any sort of shorthand, you were quickly snapped up. I was offered a job with the Attorney General's Department, and I was then later offered a job with Department of Prime Minister and Cabinet. And not understanding the government system or the departmental structure, one of my brothers suggested to me, Pandora, take the job with the Department of Prime Minister and Cabinet. And I said, oh, but I'd already accepted the job with the Attorney General's Department. And he said, no, tell them you're unable to accept that now and that you'd have to decline. So I contacted the Attorney General's Department and kindly declined and said that another opportunity had been presented to me. I then accepted the job with the Department of Prime Minister and Cabinet and started there at the beginning of 1986.
So an interesting sort of road to working there.
Absolutely. Mm. And so when I started at the Department of Prime Minister and Cabinet, I was initially placed in the typing pool where we were shown the ropes and I think it was also a testing ground to see for that cohort of typists and stenographers that were brought in who they would place into which division once they had spent their short time in the typing pool. So after a few weeks in the typing pool where I was shown how to prepare minutes, prepare letters and correspondence for the Prime Minister and the department, I was then sent to International Division. And at the time, the first Assistant Secretary of International Division was Chris Conybeare, who later went on to become, I think, the Secretary of Department of Immigration and also the Chief of Staff or Principal Private Secretary to the Prime Minister. And I was in International Division for about 6 or 7 months. And I didn't realise at the time, but International Division was seen as one of the more prestigious divisions in the department. So I was fortunate that that was the first division I was sent out to.
Right. So what brought you to work in Old Parliament House?
At the end of that first year in International Division, I then moved into Security Division for a couple of months. And an opportunity came up. I was asked if I could go to Old Parliament House, work in the Prime Minister's office one evening. I later found out that it was the night that Prime Minister Hawke hosted drinks for the staff for Christmas. And I was asked to go and look after the switchboard, mind the switchboard that night so that all staff could attend the Christmas drinks at the lodge. When I went that night, from what I can recall, the only people that were there was myself and one of the security attendants. And I think in the whole time I was there, which was about 3 hours, I took only a handful of calls, and really all it was just to take messages. But I seemed to make a good impression. I'm not sure who really noticed apart from the security attendant, but they asked me to come back. And there was a lady who worked in the Prime Minister's press office, and at that time the press office in Old Parliament House was located in the press gallery, which is different to our Parliament House, where the press office is located beside the Prime Minister's office. So I was asked to work in the press office in the press gallery for a number of weeks while one of the ladies in the press office was on leave. And at the end of that time, a lady in the main office of the Prime Minister's office went on leave, so they asked me to fill in for her. So my roles sort of rolled into one. My time in the Prime Minister's office continued, and then eventually someone in the main office left, and they asked if I'd apply for that position. The interesting thing was that I had just turned 19 when I was given that opportunity to apply for the position. And I recall a year or so later, when we were filling another role, that when the office manager was going through the applications to decide who they would put forward for the shortlist, they ruled out a number of people because they were so young, and I had to remind them that I was actually 18 when I'd started in the office and only just turned 19 when I applied for the position. And they gave me that opportunity, and they wouldn't have given me that opportunity had they not met me. And so whether Whether that changed their thinking or not, I don't know. But I'm grateful that I had already been there and been able to show them what I was capable of, that they were willing to keep me.
Just to go back a bit, why were you chosen to go in that particular night? What led them to choose you? Because it started a whole chain of events in your life.
I think it may be, I'm really not sure. I was never really privy to the decision and why I was chosen out of the cohort of stenographers and typists that were given that came in that year. But I put it down to maybe two things. One, I was given a referee report by Robert Wiley, who was an assistant secretary in International Division. And in it he wrote that I was considered one of the best of the cohort of that year. And whether that is why I stood out, I'm not sure. The second thing was that I lost my sister. She died in 1987 in September that year. And I wondered if people felt that I'd had a pretty rough year, that maybe something like this might be a nice treat.
Yes.
And that's why they gave me that opportunity.
That must have been hard, losing your sister.
It was extremely hard. My sister was born with a congenital heart defect. She had a hole in her heart, and we always lived with her being unwell, but she deteriorated over time, and I didn't really understand her illness. It was after she died that I went to see her heart specialist and you know, got some further details. And as I said, I was only 18. I was 18 when I started at Prime Minister and Cabinet, and that was the year she died, and she was 20. It was a stage in my life I'll never forget, and one I'd never wished anyone to have to go through, to lose someone so young and so close to them like that. We were very close, and I don't think I've ever really gotten over it.
She's still your sister.
She is indeed. I do miss her every day.
Yes, that's hard. Were you interested in politics at that stage?
I was 18, 19. I didn't really know what politics was. I appreciate it now, and I have a better understanding of it now because of the environments I've worked in. But at the time, I came from a family of hard workers, and the priority for my family was that we would work and we would work hard, and we never expected anything to be given to us. So I went into it with the view that I was there to do a good job and that I would learn as much as I could. I didn't really know how long this opportunity would last. It could have been a bank, it could have been anywhere, I would have done the same thing. I just went in there with the view that I was there to do a job and I would do the best job I could.
And obviously they didn't see your age. They saw the job you were doing, as if you had to remind them that, well, look, I'm only 19, don't rule people out because of their age. So they saw your competence.
They did, and that's what I'll forever be grateful for, because otherwise I may never have had that opportunity.
So which part of the building did you work in?
So apart from that first few weeks where I worked in the press gallery, in the press office that was located in the press gallery, the rest of my time was spent in the Prime Minister's main office. I worked in what we considered the front office, which was the first room that you would walk into. And in that space, there was myself, Craddock Morton, who was the cabinet officer at the time, who later went on to become the head of the National Museum, Libby Bogus, who was one of the other secretaries, Di Flaherty, who was the receptionist, Heather Mittag, Heather Lenave — Heather Mittag was a secretary, Heather Lenave was the office manager, and myself. The interesting thing was that if you have a look at the space, it's quite small. So to have six of us working in there, we were on top of each other, and if you take into account the hours that we worked, it was a fairly small space to spend so many hours together. The other thing was that a number of the staff smoked, and I didn't smoke, and I didn't think anything of it because that's just the way it was. And I did mention at one point that, you know, I might make a claim around, you know, having to work in such a small environment with smokers, but it was only ever fun because that is just the way it was. No, we didn't know any the wiser. We weren't any the wiser. No. That's the way it was.
I think it was the mid-80s, really, they brought in non-smoking government areas.
Well, it wasn't until we moved into Parliament House right. up the hill that smoking was stopped in the office.
In 1988.
And that was the transition, and I think that's why so many staff struggled when they moved to Parliament House, was because they couldn't smoke anymore. I know a number of people continued to smoke in the office, and I think there were warnings given to the office about people smoking, but people found it very difficult to transition and to cease smoking in the office. They weren't going to be told.
No, that's right. We've done it for years.
The PM was one of those.
Really?
Yes. Well, he liked his cigars. He loved to smoke a cigar. And I know that I'm not certain, but I'm fairly sure he continued to smoke those cigars in Parliament House.
I can imagine.
Oh, yes.
So who were you working for?
So in the office, each secretary had the responsibility of one or two advisors or staff in the office. I was asked to work for John Bowen, who was the international relations advisor, and Stephen Mills, who was the speechwriter. Although we worked directly to them, we also offered administrative support and secretarial support to the office more widely, because we had a roster amongst the five secretaries in the office. And I'd mentioned there was Libby Bogus, myself, Heather Mittag, Jean Hammond, and I think her name was Deborah Shaw as the last secretary. So there were five of us. So Jean Hammond, I always saw her as the backbone of the administrative side of the office. She was a great role model for me and mentor. And she took me under her wing when I started in the office. And she showed me the way of how to be, you know, a professional secretary, and just held my hand along the way. And she managed a number of things around the way the office ran and the administrative side of things. So she ran a few rosters for the secretarial staff. One was for our office hours, and two nights a week I would be able to leave at 6 o'clock. One night a week I could leave at 8 o'clock. And the other two nights of the week, I would leave at whatever time I was allowed to leave. So depending on what was being worked on by the office at the time, or any major speeches or major programs. And sometimes that would be, you know, midnight, 1 or 2 in the morning. And we would share those shifts around. And on the weekends, we would be on call. Two of us would be on call each weekend.
Right.
And the other rosters that Jean Hammond managed were travel rosters, so that we took, we shared the interstate travel around, and we would work through the five secretaries as to who would go travel with the PM on an interstate trip. She also managed an overseas roster of the short trips and the long trips.
Right.
So the short trips would be to, say, the South Pacific or New Zealand or somewhere close by, Southeast Asia, and a long trip would be Europe, United States, Africa, South America. And so again, she would allocate who would go to those on each trip based on the order of the roster.
So it was all very fair.
Absolutely. I've never worked in a fairer office.
Really?
I will always have fond memories of this office. It was, I felt, the fairest, the most well-functioning office I've ever worked in, or department or organisation I've ever worked for. There was no one-upmanship. There was complete collaboration between staff. And although I have to keep that in check, I was 19. I was very young when I started. So it was, that's the way I saw it. I've never worked in a more harmonious office. There were pressures, but people seemed to manage them so well. It was like another family to me. And a story I remember is in that first year that I was working in the office, I got my wisdom teeth out and I went into hospital for it. And I remember my family dropping me off to the hospital and off I went to complete the administration process for being admitted to the hospital. And as my time came for my operation, I became a bit nervous. And I remember going to a phone box and calling the office, and they could sense that I was nervous. Mm. And they passed me around the phone. Each of the ladies in the office would speak to me and would just talk to me gently and just, you know, make sure I was okay. But I thought they could sense that, like your family could sense that. Mm. And I thought, well, I spent so much time with these people, of course they'd sense that. Mm. So I thought, I reflect on that now and it sort of chokes me up a little bit, because it's it just showed me how important they were to me and how important I was to them.
Yeah, it's a very caring environment.
Absolutely. But it needed to be, because we worked under such extreme pressure and the hours, we looked out for each other.
Mm. Yeah.
And I've never had that again in any
office.
So
where do you think that came from?
Mm. They had the right people in the office. Mm. They had the right people in the right roles. They picked well. I've seen other offices where the right people aren't chosen for the roles. They had wise people. They had people with experience. They had people. They gave thought to how people would work together. And I just think they chose well.
Mm. So what were John and Stephen like to work for?
John Bowen was interesting. And I say this in a nice way. He was a bit like a nutty old professor. He was extremely intelligent. And he was the international relations advisor, international affairs advisor, he was much more than that. His knowledge of sport was second to none. His knowledge of music was amazing. Anything to do with the arts. He provided advisory services to the Prime Minister on such a broad range of issues. And he became really the international relations / sports / music / arts advisor. And he was the most disorganised man I've ever worked for. And he would often pile secure documents into his safe and never again would they be found. And I'm sure the organisations like ASIO and ACES and ONA would just cringe at the thought, but he would toss documents into his safe and lock them up of a night, and I don't know whether they ever appeared again. And I know those documents are numbered and registered and meant to be disposed of appropriately, and I'm sure they were, but it was always amazing to me that no matter what you wanted, or if the Prime Minister asked to see something, he could always lay his hands on it. And but he was a fantastic person to work for. And Stephen Mills, he was quite young. He was the speechwriter in the office, and I think he had a journal. He was a journalist. I think he started as a journalist, and I would help with the typing up of all the Prime Minister's speeches, and but he was also a lovely man to work for. They both looked after me very well, and I could never say anything bad about either of them.
He was a speechwriter as well as Graham Freudenberg, is that right?
Stephen Mills was the permanent speechwriter in the office. Right. Freudie, or Graham Freudenberg, would come to Canberra to assist on the bigger speeches. So he would come to work on major speeches that the Prime Minister was delivering, especially anything of a political nature. And you'd always know when Freudie was in town, because he was quite a heavy smoker, And he'd wander through the office holding a cigarette. I don't know that he actually puffed too many times, but he would just hold this cigarette out and it would burn down. And I remember the ash would just fall onto the carpet. So we knew when he was in town because we could see a trail of ash. And he'd tread in the ash and, you know, it'd rub into the carpet. And he was he was just totally oblivious to it all. But he just... He just carried this cigarette, you know, continued to carry a cigarette around the office, lit, but only ever occasionally puffed.
Just Did you ever have a typical day at work, or was there a typical day?
No. Well, each day... It's hard because it's been so long now. I'm trying to recall.
All right. I mean, obviously, you were there for long hours.
And... Yes. So each day, you knew what your role was. You would go in, you would assist your relevant boss on anything that needed doing. There was I worked in the general office. We backed up on the phone. So Di Flaherty was the receptionist at the time, and we would each help out with the phones, and they were busy, and then we'd have our peaks depending on what announcement the government had made or something that the government might have said in Parliament. But we had our own distinct roles as to what we did, and each of our bosses, as I said, would come to you and ask you to do whatever work was required of the day. But wouldn't say it was. We had some downtime too, and we had the opportunity to have fun in the office, which I think is the only thing that kept us all sane, probably.
What did you do to have fun in the office?
We would joke. We would laugh. We would some of the things that we went out together as a group. We were social outside of work as well, not a great deal because obviously we spent a lot of time with each other, but we had a glee club, and the only thing was though that I was young and I didn't drink, and I think a lot of the staff in the office found that a bit hard to understand because it was a very heavy drinking, heavy smoking culture, and I wasn't a drinker, so I didn't actually become a member of the glee club. I didn't see the sense in it. I didn't drink, so why would I join? And my boss, John Bowen, I'm not being mean, but he was a bit tight with his money, so he didn't see why he should join to become a member of the glee club. So John and I were the only two non-members, which, you know, was something that the rest of the office used to make fun of. And we would have a glee club, so there were often drinks at night, or some people would start drinking a little bit earlier than others, and I do recall one secretary in particular who used to have a beer cooler on her desk and would crack open a tin of beer at around 11 o'clock in the morning, and I think that's just what some people did to get through the day. But that was an unusual thing and not encouraged. Again, you know, I just watched and learnt, and this is the environment I was now in. I didn't see it as being anything different. No. And I didn't know any better. So first Prime Minister's office I'd worked in, so how would I know what you did in a Prime Minister's office? But we went out regularly, and the Glee Club did organise an annual dinner, which John Bowen and I did not attend, again, because we were non-members, but John prepared a lovely speech that he asked to have delivered at the first Glee Club dinner, and we called it the Osvaldo Meneghello Oration. And Osvaldo Meneghello was the Prime Minister's valet at the time, and he was Italian, he was very Italian, and he was, I think, a soccer player, a very good soccer player when he lived in Italy. Anyway, the PM was on a Pritikin diet, very strict Pritikin diet at the time, but Ozzy seemed to find a way around that, and the lodge would provide food that the Prime Minister was to eat, but Ozzy would always make sure that the PM got anything he wanted, and, you know, if that was not in line with the Pritikin diet, well, that didn't matter, because Ozzy had his own version of Pritikin diet and made sure the PM had all the little treats that he wished.
That's Ozzy who...
said that was Ozzy, and when we moved up to Parliament House, he left the office to open Ozzy's general store.
Right.
And although the spelling of Ozzy's apartment house is AUSSIE, it was actually spun off Osvaldo Meneghello, Ozzy being the PM's valet. And he ran that store for quite a number of years with his wife, who was a staff member for a minister in Parliament House. And they ran that store very successfully for quite a number of years before then, I think, selling or moving on anyway.
So apart from the Glee Club, did you socialise outside with work hours with people?
I did. But as I said, it wasn't a great deal because we spent so much time together. Mm. When you finally left the office, it was nice to be able to spend time with family and friends away from that environment, because it was all encompassing. But I remember my 21st birthday, which wasn't here in Old Parliament House. I celebrated my 21st in New Parliament House, and a number of the staff came to my 21st birthday, which was lovely. And we would often have office dinners, and I do remember one dinner up at Parliament House, up at the New Parliament House, where we had a dinner together, and I've got some photos of that, which I've provided Barry York. We attended office functions together, and there was the famous PM's cricket match, and we would go along to events like that. You went to so many events with the office, like formal events, or were invited to different occasions, that in a way you wanted to disappear from that environment, and you wanted to go and do something else. And for me, I worked in the office from the ages of 19 to 21, and they were, you know, important years as a young person. You know, I would see my friends going out of a night and hear about the stories of having fun out together or on weekends, but I was often too tired from the hours that I'd worked through the week to be able to always join them or to go out with them, or work restricted whether I could go. So I did miss that, and I think that's what led to me leaving the office, because I missed the opportunities of being out with friends. I was young, and although I was grateful for the opportunity, and now when I reflect back, I think I wish there was more I remembered about my time there. I wish there were more things that I may have kept to remind me of some of the times that I had in that office. I did what I did because that was my job.
That was your job.
Yes.
Were there any other social clubs in Old Parliament House that you joined, apart from, you know, you've got the Glee Club for the Prime Minister's office, but...
The office, for me, my life was that office.
Right.
I didn't socialise too much outside of the office. There were a number of corridor parties that would take place in the building, and there was also the non-members bar through the courtyard. I have to honestly admit, I never went to the non-members bar, again, for the fact that I was in the office for such long hours that when I wasn't working, I wanted to go home. And I wasn't a drinker, which was, as I said, very unusual. So I didn't frequent places like that.
No.
And I think also, when I first started in the press office, in the press gallery, I was warned so many times by the staff in the office not to speak to anyone, not to tell the media anything. And they put such fear into me that I was so afraid of saying anything to anyone. And it was a great training ground, however, because it prepared me for jobs in other offices later, that I would never say anything because I was always afraid that it would come back to bite me. So I didn't want to go to places where I might be placed in a position where someone will ask me something about the office. Mm. I didn't want to be in a position where I might say something and then get into trouble later.
Mm. Did any press journalists ask you a question or press you for information?
Some journalists did, but not while I was in that office.
Okay.
In later jobs and later positions, I've been asked things about the office that I worked in, but I always declined to answer. Mm. But they were always looking for a story.
Mm.
I remember one night in particular, it was around the time of the John Brown resignation. Mm. He was a tourism minister. And the Prime Minister was in Hobart. I recall Hobart, I could be wrong though, with Hazel. And the issue blew up here in Canberra. And at the time, the only phone with a speaker on it was in the Prime Minister's office. In this building, was in the Prime Minister's office. So we had on one night that I was working back late, John Brown, Gareth Evans, Graham Richardson, and I'm fairly sure, definitely John Button. I don't think there was anyone else. I do recall those four sitting in the Prime Minister's office, and John Button, who was the leader of government in the Senate, he was sitting in the Prime Minister's chair. And the other gentlemen were in there discussing what they were going to do, or at least what John Brown was going to do. So once they'd had a discussion, they asked to get the Prime Minister on the phone. In the meantime, the